You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome to episode 27 of Meet the Farmers, for which I've travelled just a few miles down the road to speak to a farmer who's actually a distant relative of mine, Guy Smith.
Allegedly.
Guy farms in St. Osyth in Essex and is also the deputy president of the National Farmers Union, or I should say that he's speaking in a personal capacity today. We're recording today just before the end of the year, and so we'll be looking back on the events of 2018, looking ahead to 2019, and I'll also be asking Guy about his farm and his NFU career. Guy, thank you for speaking to me. This is an interview I've really been looking forward to.
Ben, nice to see you. And I suppose to bore your listeners with a little bit of our family's history, we're both very traditional North East Essex family farmers with the Eagle family and the Smith family. They go back, 200, 300 years, both in what we call the Tendring Hundred Peninsula. And you and me know that not many farmers in this area have that sort of longevity, because if you haven't got a Scottish grandfather around these parts, you're an ethnic minority, because the English farmers all got cleared out in the first half of the 19th century, largely because I think the English farmers, they got sort of, I don't know, maybe bad, lazy ways in the time of the agricultural depression. And the story was that the local farmers were walking away from the farms, and the Scots boys got to hear about these tenanted farms. They could have more or less no rent, and they came down in their, literally in their droves as clans. And so it's quite unusual for farmers in this part of the world to be able to trace themselves back to sort of the 18th century. So it's nice to have this Eagle-Smith connection, although you're at the top of the Tendring Peninsula on the Naze, yeah, and we're at the bottom of the Tendring Peninsula on the Calm Point area.
Yeah. Two proper Essex boys.
That's right.
So this year, from Brexit to the weather, really, it's been quite a memorable one for farmers. What will you remember this last year from a farming point of view?
I was sort of thinking about this, writing a column for the Farmers Weekly, and it is a bit of an earnest year, hasn't it, really, been with the beast from the east and a late, difficult start to spring in farming terms, and then immediately falling into this endless drought where we got sort of 59 days without rain. And as you know, one of my claims to fame is the driest spot in the British Isles. Yeah.
Count that as number one, this has been said today.
This is so. And not to be taken lightly, page 22 of the Guinness Book of Records, I'm there. It's not a false claim. Yes, I keep the rain gauge underneath a tree next to a high wall, blah, blah, blah. And as you know, there are a number of spots in Britain that claim to be the driest spot, and they're usually on around the Thames estuary because the summer showers in particular shoot up the estuary and go round the points like where you are on the nasal, we are on Calm Point. We go in 2018 from difficult spring weather to difficult summer weather. Mm. Although I think harvest wasn't too bad. My old dad, who's passed away now, used to have a phrase when people used to ask him how harvest was going. He used to have this intermediate phrase where he'd say, "It was better than we expected, but we weren't expecting much," which always was a neat way to sort of non-committal as to how well things were going. And I think that's very true.
Politics around the family. Then.
That's right. That's right. He was quite shrewd, actually. And I think that's very true of this year, that yields are okay. But I think had we not come on the back of that drought, it would have seemed mediocre rather than surprisingly good. But prices were up, especially if you were smart enough to sell everything about August the 2nd, which I wasn't. But I think, you know, if we did lose something on the yield roundabout, we gained it on the market swing. So all in all, not too bad a year, I suppose, farming-wise, coming out of a very difficult period. The autumn has been a bit droughty around these parts, but hasn't proved too bad. And then, as you say, I'm Deputy President of the National Farmers Union. And so I am that dreaded thing. I am the weekend farmer now. I only farm at weekends. I'm 4 days away doing the NFU stuff. And, you know, to be frank, after 360 days, if I don't hear the word Brexit for the next five, I'll be more than happy, yeah.
So we've also had this year the introduction of the Agriculture Bill. We'll have the second reading going through the Commons in early next year.
Yeah.
Do you think the Ag Bill goes, as it currently stands, goes far enough? And does it provide sufficient certainty so that farmers can plan for the long term?
It's a curate's egg. There are parts of it that we quite like. It talks about the Secretary of State being able to intervene in the case of market collapse. It talks about more transparency in the food chain. And we think that is a sensible part of agricultural policy. What it doesn't do enough is talk about food production. Mm. And, you know, as far as we can see, some of the measures outlined in the Ag Bill are as pertinent to Trafalgar Square as they are to an acre of English farmland. So we want more from the bill. It's at where it's lost in Rally Brexit at the moment, but it's going through the House of Lords shortly. We want to see agriculture named on the face of the bill. We want to see more reference to food production. So, I mean, obviously, you know, this bill will have a life of its own, and we want sort of future legislators, when they look back on the bill, to recognise that its purpose was to address farming, food production, agriculture, you know, rather than just the environment.
Let's turn to Brexit again directly. So there's still a possibility that Britain will crash out of the EU without a deal. And some commentators have presented no deal as an absolute crisis situation with perishable food piling up in ports, empty shelves, lower food environment, employment and animal welfare standards. What would no deal mean for British farmers from your point of view?
Well, if we crash out on March 29th and move to WTO trading understanding, I mean, the first point is that you can't unravel 40 years of a trading relationship overnight. It'll be worryingly chaotic, in my opinion. Now, I don't want to sort of get into the old should we leave, shouldn't we leave debate again, but to my mind, we joined the EEC, as it was then, in the 1970s, in a phased manner over a period of years. And it strikes me that the equal should be true if we leave, that it should be done in a phased manner over a period of years. And it could be chaotic. Now, I know, you know, people say, oh, this is just Project Fear and whatever. But as you say, food is largely perishable. The way this nation is fed through the multiple supermarkets, love them or loathe them, is just on just-in-time arrival basis. And it's like walking on thin ice. If you fall through, it'll get bloody chilly. Mm.
Talking in transition, as we're talking about a 7-year transition within the change from the current common agricultural format in terms of basic payments and environmental payments. Within that 7-year period, so we're going to see a reduction in BPS payments. We're also going to see possibly a transformation in the way that environmental stewardship, countryside stewardship, is carried out. After those 7 years, what would be your vision for payments? Would we be looking for a payments by results model or something else in terms of conservation in the countryside?
In terms of the future design of what we call the environment schemes, and here on this farm, we've been heavily involved in them for the last 10, 20 years. First countryside stewardship and then ELS, HLS, as we call it, and now we're back into countryside stewardship. And I am sort of involved in the union with the future of this path. And of course, as you say, it looks like that's where ag policy is going to sit in the main about environmental delivery. Personally, I am wary of what they call the outcome-based concept. I mean, take a patch we've got down on the marsh, just half a mile south of here. And what I have to do on there is provide wild bird food. And last year it worked really well. We drilled quinoa and buckwheat and whatever in early May, came up, provided heaps of food for a multitude of different varieties. Brilliant. Outcome, excellent. But, you know, drilled the 5 hectare patches, I had to do so. This year, we drilled it in early May, and as we know, we went straight into drought, and very little came up. So very little outcome. Now, in future times, if I'm going to be paid according to the outcome, although I went to my best efforts to drill the patch and provide it again, and nothing came up, is that then fail? I don't get paid. I would, you know, much rather the fact that long as I show I drilled it, I'd have the area there that can be measured out, tick those boxes, that's fine. So I suppose what I'm saying in a very long-winded way is that outcome-based environment schemes are all very well, but A, who's going to act as judge and jury over whether they've been successful? And B, you know, what if the weather, which always has the last laugh, cheats you in your best endeavours? Should you then not be paid? So that's why I prefer prescriptive schemes, although I understand the limitations.
No, that's exactly my theory as well. I mean, this year we've had a very similar problem. In the same year, two different plots, a mile apart.
Yeah.
One is, as I'm so pleased with, it is done, yeah, it's looking fantastic, it's serving its purpose,
yeah.
And the other completely and utterly failed.
Yeah.
So how does that balance out, and how is that actually going to work in reality?
Yeah.
2018 has seen a rise in the interest of flexitarian and vegan diets.
Yeah.
We've also seen a further backlash against sugar. Looking into your crystal ball, what diet trends do you see taking forth in 2019, and how might farmers need to shift their priorities alongside these, if at all?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's one that occupies us as well. You know, in one analysis, farmers simply have to grow what people want to eat. It's not the other way around. People don't have to eat what farmers want to grow. Mm. So if diet and fashion changes and market demand changes, which it does. I mean, in the last 20 years, we've seen a movement away from red meat to white meat. Then the farming industry responds. And so we've seen a huge expansion of poultry and some retraction of sheep and beef. And that's just market dynamics, which you can't defy. But I suppose there is this element of marketing, people being persuaded by political causes what they should eat. And clearly this year we've seen a huge push by the vegan lobby to conflate three issues. Diet, where they're trying to argue that red meat is unhealthy. Animal welfare, where it seemed to be that keeping animals is cruel. And then climate change, where it's argued that these animals emit a lot of GHG and therefore they're bad for the environment. Now, it's wrong to conflate those three issues. They should be debated one by one. On diet, you know, we make the case that red meat in proportion in a balanced diet is perfectly healthy. There's no issue with it making you ill. In terms of animal welfare, we'd argue that British farmers have one of the best animal welfare records in the world. So if you source your meat locally, you're supporting a high welfare system. And on climate change, it is more complicated. You can't deny that ruminants do emit a lot of methane, and that is a GHG. But we would argue that, you know, for the average citizen, if they're looking to reduce their carbon footprint, they should think about things like transport and insulating their house and how they use energy before they worry about their diet. But we would be in favour of consumers being more exacting in the way they source their red meat. So try and find a local farmer that has a well-grazed sward, which is a good carbon sink, does his bit to try and reduce carbon emissions. And there is some exciting new technology now coming forward. I was in a dairy farm in Lancashire 2 years ago where they're feeding garlic and ginger supplements, and that reduces the amount of methane their dairy cows are emitting. So I think there are some technical fixes to this. I think this knee-jerk idea of eat less red meat and be healthier, be nice to animals and save the planet is a bit of a spin, and we as an industry sort of need to respond to it.
Let's stick with climate change. Looking out on us now, and it's an issue that both of us share, which is quite rare within the farming community, but it's an issue of seawalls and sea level rise.
Yeah.
How much of your farm is below sea level here?
Half, so about 600 acres, below the high tide level. If it wasn't for that mile of seawall that we're looking out on now to the south, my farm would be regularly consumed by the North Sea.
As it was, of course, in 1953.
Indeed. So when Dad woke up on February the 1st, 1953, he found the North Sea half a mile closer to his front door than what it was when he went to bed the previous night.
And it came close in 2013?
So we've seen two big surges, haven't we, just recently, 13 and 17.
17 was the other.
Yeah. And I've never seen it so close to the top of the wall. And I used to be a little bit of a... not denier, but I didn't used to believe that the sea levels are going to rise meters. I thought it was overstating it, now having seen those two tides get very close to the top of the wall, I suspect that the chances of me seeing another 53 in my lifetime are, they're probably 50-50.
Let's turn to the farm here, because there's lots going on and there's various family members doing various things.
Yeah. As you know, farming families can be complicated. So basically, there's four siblings. My brother, who is a dairy farmer, and his son, who milked 200 Holsteins here on 350 acres. Then there's my youngest sister, Penny. She runs the sort of farm diversifications. So she's got a golf course and an open farm towards the sort of Clacton end of the farm, where we're closer to urban areas. And then there's my other sister, who lives in New Zealand, and I farm her 350 acres alongside mine, and it's mainly 700 acres cropped. So that's how it works, but it's all done within the same corporate structure. It's not as if we're not tenants, but we are sort of we're ring fenced within the same corporate structure.
Okay. And in terms of operation, because obviously you're spending a lot of time out on the road, you're an FU role.
Yeah.
I think you contract out the spraying.
Yeah, that's right. So Hanford, who you know,
yep.
They do the spraying, but the rest I try and do. I do everything in house apart from the spraying. So yeah. I have one part time contractor on 700 acres, and then we just put 170 acres into a council stewardship scheme. Which is sort of low maintenance grass, so that requires less management. So yeah, I am a weekend farmer, and I'm not very hands on, and the farming has become a lot cruder in my absence. So we only have one tractor. The one good thing about the NFU job is the civil service and the politicians and a lot of NFU staff take August off, so I can come back to the farm and get on the farm.
A useful month to be able to have a lesson.
Exactly.
You were a law student.
That's right.
And you worked for a time as a researcher at the Social Sciences Research Council.
Yeah.
Do you think that early experience away from the farm was important, formative, especially perhaps with your NFU responsibilities hat on?
Yeah, very much so. And this sounds very up my own backside, so I apologise for that. But I think a lot of the things I learned being a law student was about advocacy, and that's useful, I think, in the NFU role. And as you infer, I think getting time away from a farm is good for anyone to do. And I'm a big fan of Nuffield farming,
yep.
Where young farmers are given a bursary to go and travel and look at
other farms. I think pretty much... well over half of guests on this podcast have been Nuffields, whether I've known it or not at the time.
Yeah, and it does exactly that. Travel expands the mind. And the thing about Nuffield is because, for your generation, travel probably has been made so much more available than it was to my generation 30 years ago because of cheap flights. So the lure of being able to travel doesn't have quite the kudos that it used to, maybe. But what Nuffield does is, because its origins are part of the Nuffield Institute, it opens doors. So if you want to go and visit a large beef cutting operation in Sao Paulo in Brazil, and you put your card forward and it's got Nuffield written on it, someone might recognize that, and you get to speak to the CEO, not just the plant manager. And that's the point. It opens doors, and you know, I had a brilliant time doing my Nuffield, and it's very much part of how I sort of do other things now in the NFU.
I know you've already said it on Will's podcast, Rock and Roll Farming, but I want to hear it again. The story, your Spanish story.
Yeah, well, again, the other thing is that, you know, Nuffield, it throws you out there. Okay. So I'm not saying we're not sort of Victorian explorers looking for the source of the Nile or anything, but it does sort of expose you to a bit of rough and tumble. So for me, the first night I'm away, I'm in Pamplona in Spain, and then in the morning there's a knock on the door, and there's two plainclothes police guys there with holsters and weapons and so forth, and they can't speak a word of English, and I speak very little Spanish, but we get enough to say I have to go with them to the police station. And in my sort of weird imperial way, I thought there was a telegram at the police station for me or something, but unbeknownst to me, I was being arrested, and I was being interviewed, interrogated, which I was for an hour, and again being interrogated by someone who spoke no English, and I spoke very little Spanish apart from the one useful phrase, lo siento, mi hablo no español, I'm sorry, I don't speak Spanish. And after an hour, suddenly he looked at me and some light bulb moment went on, and he said, lo siento, and he sort of ushered me out of the police station. And so this is in downtown Pamplona, this is Basque country, this is pop mark police stations that have been aimed at by Basque militants. All the police are twitchy with firearms, but anyway, I'm sent back to the hotel, and as I go back at the hotel, the two guys that came and took me away, I gestured them in to go and talk to the guy behind reception, because I know he spoke English and Spanish, and so he said, you know, what the hell just happened? And so they explained to him that they're looking for an American called Guy Smith, who is a drug runner, who uses prostitutes.
It's
a welcome to Spain. He used prostitutes from North Africa as drug mules and then murdered them when he got the drugs off them. Charming chap. Just happened to have my name, God bless him. And I remember I said to the reception guy, I said, so what, they come in and they check the hotel register and they see Guy Smith, and then they take you away for questioning. He goes, yep, that's basically what happened. And I said, and I'm spending the next 10 days in Spain. Is this going to happen every morning? And he goes, well, could do. And then I said, should I change my name? And he goes, no, don't do that. Because that might look even stranger. The reason I mention it is that every sort of Nuffield scholar has that sort of story about something that happened. And that's all part of the character building experience.
Something else we have in common is our shared enjoyment of writing and of history.
Yeah.
Where does that come from for you?
Got on at school and stuff like that, and have this academic side to me, I suppose, and university education, and I've always enjoyed writing. And so, you know, to go back to the Nuffield thing, by some fluke, I won an award as the best presenter at the Nuffield conference, and then the editor of a farming magazine comes up to me at that point and says, would you like to write for us? And I say, I'd love to write for a farming magazine, and I've been writing for farming magazines for the last 20 years. And I enjoy it a lot, and it gives me a lot of interaction.
We all enjoy reading your
That's very kind as well. But I like the antis as well. The people that one bloke wrote to me and said, "Dear Mr. Smith, I objected to your article so much. You represent everything that is wrong with British agriculture.
Oh, that's brilliant.
In fact, I was so inflamed, I read your article twice, and I thought, good result.
You succeeded. Exactly. There we are." When did you first get involved with the NFU?
In this writing role, having lots of opinions on everything, more opinions than was good for me, I used to occasionally have a stab at the NFU. Although I wasn't, we were always members and we were loyal members and always paid out our subs every year because we saw the organisation was worthwhile and very necessary. But I used to have the occasional poke at it. And they said to me, well, if you've got all these opinions about the NFU, you ought to get involved. And so I was put up as Essex delegate in 2002 and then sat on council and then sort of chaired the comms committee and then had the opportunity to stand as an office holder, 5 years ago, and yeah. Got lucky.
I'm sure it's a bit more than that. But anyway, for listeners who don't know you in your role now, what does the deputy president of the NFU actually do day to day?
So there's a team of three of us. So Minette, and it's great to serve as the deputy to the first female NFU president. And she is a force of nature. Take my hat off to her. And I think she's the right person at the right time to be leading the NFU.
It's impossible to get an interview with her, tell you that.
Yeah, well,
she's such a busy lady.
Stick with it. You might get lucky. So there's three office holders, Minette, myself, and Stuart Roberts, who is the vice president. And then we all sort of have portfolios of responsibilities. So I will pick up sort of pesticide lobbying and integrated pest management, science and technology, banking, rural crime, environment schemes, climate change and those sorts of issues. It's very wide ranging. And then so I will, you know, go and give papers on this, that and the other, working with NFU staff. And then a lot of time is simply just going around the country to talk to members. So we're just at the end of what we call AGM season, where every NFU county has an AGM. Office holders I usually go and attend. So I've done Norfolk AGM, Dorset AGM, Lancashire AGM, Lincolnshire, Norfolk.
Is it however many miles do you rack up a year?
I did a little rec here. In the last 2 months, I've done over 4,000 miles, which is nuts. And I try and go on the train when I can, but things always let you down. I love the job, and people say to me, you know, do you enjoy being deputy president of the NFU? And there's a simple reply, if I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It's not compulsory, I'm not a martyr, and there are other things I can do. So I do enjoy it, and I do enjoy meeting NFU members across the country. It's the miles in between that can be the fag.
Yeah. I'm sure you get this question a lot, but so there's 46,000 members of the NFU.
Yeah.
And whenever I speak to non-farmers, they're always surprised when I say that actually there is a huge amount of disagreement within the farming community on lots of different issues. We don't have a single voice. We are all individuals who have lots of different opinions.
Yeah.
I know that the NFU isn't wholly a representative organisation, but how do you, practically speaking, represent that many views when generating policy? Well,
carefully, I think, is a phrase. Yeah, you're right. The NFU, in its sort of origins, and as you know, I've sort of researched history of the NFU, one of the phrases I like about it is that the NFU, its triumph was it brought together the one class of men who would never combine. Because, as you know, farmers are instinctively individualistic. Yeah. We are quite varied and increasingly more so as we all sort of go to our sector specialist areas more and more. So the strength of the NFU is that it is a one-stop shop. So if government or journalists or pressure groups or agencies want to speak to about farming, they go to the NFU because they will find whatever they want in that tent. But you're right that we can be fractious. There are sometimes some differences between farmers, tenants and owner-occupiers and organic and non-organic and mountaintop and hilltop and dale and flatlands. It goes on. But the point I always make to NFU members is at the end of the day, we've got far more in common than we do differences. And we need to remember that when we're lobbying. So we speak with a united voice, which I think 9 times out of 10 we do.
Tell me about your time in Europe, because you spend, and certainly have spent the last few years, a fair amount of time in Brussels.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about fragmentation. You get into the European Union and you go from Cadiz in the south, where they're farming rice and sunflowers and whatever, you know, up into Scandinavia, where they're grazing goats and sheep on mountainsides, you realise that, that fragmentation gets even, you know, more exaggerated. But COPA is the umbrella organisation, and then the NFU affiliates to COPA.
So that's an acronym that we haven't had yet.
I can't. It's French.
Kind I was going to say. I can't remember what it stands for as well.
Yeah, it's actually just to make the situation worse. It's COPA Kajika. Yeah. But basically, it's the farming representative organisations coming together under one tent to lobby in Brussels as one farming voice. So, you know, the NFU's equivalents in France, the FNSEA, will be represented in Germany, the DBV, endless acronyms again. But yeah, it pulls together all those.
I think listeners are used to it by now.
Yeah, that's part of the farming job. And so there you try and lobby. So the one issue I get closest involved with is pesticides. So pesticides can be banned by Brussels or they can be banned by the UK. So you have to sort of lobby on both fronts. Now, obviously, if or when we leave the European Union, the focus will switch more to London and Whitehall rather than to Brussels and the EU. It's likely, I think, that to a certain extent we will shadow some of EU regulation, so we will have to keep some eye on what's happening in Brussels. So glyphosate is probably the cause celebre. Mm. If that gets banned in the EU in 3 or 4 years' time, it would clearly come under pressure in the UK. So we need to make sure we're still lobbying for glyphosate in Brussels, even if we've left the European Union.
Mm. When was the first time you met a Secretary of State? And how did you feel before that?
That's a really good question, because I suppose when I was younger, I always sort of looked at politicians as, I mean, I wasn't that naive, but as sort of a big reverence for them. Yeah. You know, these were the guys running the country, and therefore they were sort of demigods. But when you actually meet them, you realise they're just human beings with all the frailties of being a human being like you or me. So I've met a few of them. I met Paterson, was the first Secretary of State when I was Vice President. Liz Truss, so I really like Liz Truss. She's not everyone's cup of tea, but I thought she was a really good Secretary of State and came from a really good rural constituency in Southwest Norfolk. And now we have Mr. Gove.
So we had Ledson in there as well for a short time.
Yeah.
we've had our run.
Yeah, we're like Chelsea, aren't we? We change the manager every 9 months. And Gove is probably the most interesting of them. Big hitting politician, but a consummate politician. So when you meet him, he's charming and personable, and you feel listened to and slightly swayed by him. But you realise that once he's gone and talked to someone else, they get the same treatment, although they might have said completely the opposite thing. And he has his own agenda, and he sees it through.
What messages do you think that he will be giving in a couple of weeks at both the Oxford Farming Conference and the Oxford Real Farming Conference? Will they be the same message, or will they be slightly different?
Well, I mean, Brexit and the Theresa May plan, I imagine, are still going to be quite energised then. So he does seem to be backing the Prime Minister, although there has been some doubts about him in the past. So I imagine he will be continuing with that line that we need to back the May plan and exit the European Union accordingly. I think he'll be talking about the Ag Bill, about how it's sort of the future vision for agriculture based around the environment. But, you know, he will do his usual trick of charming the audience, making them feel that agriculture and farming is by far the most important industry in the land. And he will talk up the importance of food production. But if you grind down onto the minutiae of what he's proposing, I think there are issues about whether he's really worried about where this country gets fed from. And, you know, you can see a train of thought sort of going back, you know, to almost the Corn Law repeal, where this country is fed from other parts of the world and manufactures things rather than grows things. And obviously, as a farmer, I am not happy with that vision, because I think food's important, that we should have a certain proportion of our own food needs as a nation produced in our own country. And I think Britain is an eminently suitable place to grow food, because I think our standards are internationally high in terms of welfare, in terms of environment responsibility, and in terms of food safety. And if we simply export our food production to other parts of the world, then the net effect is an erosion of standards, and I don't see that as a sensible vision going forward.
What are you looking forward to, and what are your concerns going into 2019?
Well, obviously, we have the manner of Brexit. Is it going to be hard, or is it going to be soft or chewy or whatever? I suspect there will be some fudge which will see us through.
Yeah.
But you're relying on politicians to do the right thing at the last minute, and that, you could say, is quite scary. Mm. So I think we're in that sort of world politically. I mean, you know, we're in a crazy place where we have the Tory party, who are riven over the one central issue they're wrestling with, about leaving the European Union, could not be more fractured or split ideologically as they are now, you know, with a large part of the party not loyal to their leader. And then you have the Labour Party, and also in a very curious position, I think, where we need to remember that 75% of current Labour MPs just 2 years ago signed a motion of no confidence in Corbyn. And so, you know, politically, I think they're quite fragmented as well, although I think in the last 12 months they've done well to paper over those cracks. But I think the prospect of a hard Brexit may sort of fracture those cracks again. So politically, it's extremely volatile. So we've got that going on. We've got the bill going through, which I fear will go through largely unamended because of all the political attention on you-know-what. But hey, as some farmer reminded me the other day, the wheat will still grow, the cows will still milk. We're not going to fall off a cliff. Maybe we are, I don't know.
I have to ask you this question. Are you going to be standing for NFU president next time?
This is months away, man. This is months
away. This is my opportunity, though.
Yeah. I honestly, Ben, I don't know. I've done 6 years as novice holder of the NFU by then. We've got a really interesting project lined up in the business. So my son is a chef, and we've just got planning permission to build a pretty large cafe restaurant on the edge of Clacton. Yeah. So that's a really exciting new venture for us as a business. So I may feel it's time to go back to the farm. But hey, you know, maybe I'm a bit like I'm on a drug. And come with, so January 2020, when I have to make my mind up, maybe the lure of another 2 years as an novice holder of the NFU will keep me in that loop. Who knows?
We will see. Right, we're going to try something new on Meet the Farmers now. We're introducing something called the 1 Minute Soapbox, which gives guests an opportunity to talk about a subject of their choice. Could be anything, could be farming, could be non-farming. For 1 minute. Guy, you all ready?
Yeah, I think it's about technology. You know, we know as tractor drivers that when you get into a tractor nowadays, increasingly you program it rather than drive it. And the new technology around telemetry and satellite positioning and computer power and image recognition and cameras, you know, they really are transforming farming fast. And it gives us the ability to, you know, meet climate change, carbon footprint targets, so we use resources more efficiently. And I think it's really exciting, and to promote the industry as being, you know, IT heavy. So we get the science graduates want to think that agriculture is a place for them going forward. However, as we know, that technology is not cheap. And if farming isn't allowed to make a profit going forward, I worry it won't harness all those opportunities.
That's your 1 minute. That's really good. We'll leave it there, but thank you so much, Guy, for that. That's been a brilliant conversation. And I'll look forward to catching up with you next year, potentially at Oxford. Speaking of which, the next episode will be coming to you from Oxford, as it's conference season once again. And for the first time, I've been granted access to both the Oxford Real Farming Conference and the Oxford Farming Conference. So I'm looking forward to bringing you stories from both of those. That'll be next time. I've been Ben Eagle and this has been Meet the Farmers. You can catch me at thinkingcountry.com or on Instagram or Twitter at Benji_Eagle. I'll look forward to you joining me next time.